Chapter 15. New Techniques. Sandrine. Claudio Guarnieri had developed uncommon mental and physical dexterity in a decade of tracking cyber surveillance weapons like Pegasus. Just this moment, on the floor of Le Mans's barely lit auditorium, at the end of a long day in early May 2021, Claudio was putting both to good use. The head of Amnesty International's security lab was sitting in a low-slung armchair, his legs akimbo, with his right ankle resting on his left knee to form his own working table. He was typing furiously on a laptop that rested on that makeshift table, while occasionally glancing at the screen of an Android phone, which was connected to the laptop by a short wire and rested precariously on the arch of his right shoe. Claudio was also mindful of the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter seated just a few feet away and nudging closer, trying to make out the characters dancing across the screen of his laptop. Dana Priest of The Washington Post had lots of questions. "Okay, what does that mean?" she asked, pointing at his screen. "Just one second," Claudio said patiently, and continued typing in silence for about half a minute. "All right," he finally said, picking up the cell phone to read something on the screen. "I think I found something." "Oh, good," Dana said, and then watched as Claudio fell silent again and went back to punching keys on his laptop and glancing over at the phone on his shoe and punching more keys. This went on for 3 excruciating minutes while Dana cooled her jets. She really wanted the secrets inside that cell phone unlocked, like right now, because there was a very real chance that device held evidence of Pegasus spyware used against one of Jamal Khashoggi's relatives around the time of his assassination. For Dana and everybody else from the Washington Post, especially after Shalev Julio's repeated denials, implicating Pegasus in Khashoggi's murder was, as Dana called it, the golden get. Each of our growing number of reporting partners understood the potential explosiveness of this story. If we could nail it down, it would likely be the marquee story of the day one rollout of the Pegasus Project publication. But Dana was especially invested. She had met Jamal Khashoggi on a trip to Bahrain in 2013, and always remembered him as soft-spoken and cautious. He was clear-eyed about the shortcomings of the Saudi regime at the time, but also one of its most dependable defenders, as he had been for decades. Jamal had even worked as a media advisor for the Saudi ambassador in Washington and London. But when newly anointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman began purging Saudis he found threatening to his personal rule, by arrest and later by execution, Jamal believed he had to choose a side. "I spent 6 months silent, reflecting on the state of my country and the stark choices before me," he wrote in his debut column in the Washington Post's Global Opinion section in September 2017. "It was painful to me several years ago when several friends were arrested. I said nothing. I didn't want to lose my job or my freedom. I worried about my family. I have made a different choice now. I have left my home, my family, and my job, and I am raising my voice. To do otherwise would betray those who languish in prison. I can speak when so many cannot. I want you to know that Saudi Arabia has not always been as it is now. We Saudis deserve better." Khashoggi warned again and again that the new Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, was a volatile and retrograde force in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. "Replacing old tactics of intolerance with new ways of repression is not the answer," he wrote of MBS in April 2018. Jamal Khashoggi's willingness to raise his voice cost him. Just over a year after he published the first of his 14 global opinion columns, he was dead, brutally assassinated by the Crown Prince's chosen hit team in a foreign country. It was such an outrageous crime, Dana says. I don't remember ever having a case of a journalist who was so clearly killed by a government without that government even trying to hide it. It broke every norm of humanity, of civilized nations, and of international law. And it was all just right there in our face. There were serious allegations, and even scattered bits of evidence, that Jamal or people around him had been targeted by Pegasus, which was then used to track him just before his murder, and to track his family and friends just after his death. But nothing solid enough to penetrate NSO's wall of denial. New possibilities, however, were beginning to emerge from the data that Amnesty International, Forbidden Stories, and our early partners had access to. We had identified cell phone numbers in the data belonging to Jamal's fiance, Hatija Genghis, and her attorney, to Jamal's son Abdullah, to Jamal's emergency contact in Istanbul, Yasin Aktay, who also happened to be a close friend of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, even to the prosecutor in Istanbul who was overseeing the investigation into Jamal's murder. All of those selections had taken place in the immediate aftermath of the assassination. But we hadn't yet approached any of these people about allowing the security lab to do the forensics on their cell phones. The cell phone resting on Claudio's foot that evening in May 2021 was of a higher order. The number of this cell phone had also been in the data, and its owner identified less than a month earlier by a different reporter at the Post, who had the number in her contact file. The phone belonged to Hanan Elater, an Egyptian-born stewardess living in the Washington suburb of Alexandria, Virginia, who had quietly wed Jamal in a religious ceremony 4 months before his death. Neither Hanan, the wife, nor Hatija, the fiancé, seemed to have been aware of the other. Hanan had known Jamal for almost a decade, but they had grown close in 2016, while he was living under quasi-house arrest in Saudi Arabia and often depressed. After Jamal fled to Washington in 2017, Hanan says, she called him every morning at 7 to buck him up. Jamal had promised his terrified ex-wife in Riyadh that he would quietly disappear into the U.S. and refrain from speaking ill of the Saudi regime until things changed, until it was safe. But Hanan encouraged him to accept the offer from the Washington Post, she told us, and to use his column to call attention to what was happening in his home country. The relationship turned romantic in March 2018, Hanan says, and the couple were married that June. Hanan was hesitant to help when Dana first approached her. She had lost her job with Emirates Airline and was living in hiding, afraid she and her family were being watched by the security services of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But Dana, with the backing of Hanan's attorney, convinced her to help us. Hanan allowed Dana to do a backup of the two Android phones she was using in the months before Jamal's murder, which Dana uploaded to Claudio and Danica's forensic platform. Some of the lines of code looked interesting on the screens in Berlin, but Claudio had been unable to make any definite findings because, as he had already learned from long experience, Android backups offered so little data to work with. Claudio asked Dana to bring the phones with her to our all-hands-on-deck meeting in Paris in the second week of May 2021. Hanan relented, entrusting Dana with the phones and all the necessary passwords. So there sat one of those cell phones in Paris, perched face up on Claudio's shoe while he typed away at his laptop for those 3 long minutes. Okay, so this is one, Claudio finally said to Dana, showing her an SMS message on Hanan's phone. This is one message. Is that coming to her? Dana asked. Yeah. Dana pointed out that the message was made to look like it was sent by Hanan's sister, who was inviting Hanan to download a new photo from PhotoBucket. Yeah, so this is a tactic we've seen many times, Claudio explained. They send a message pretty generic like that, and they include a link. Dana was writing down the domain name of the link sent to Hanan. https://myfiles.photo/svikhje. This is definitely a message that would have likely triggered the exploitation of the browser, Claudio said. So would the person have to click on that link? Dana asked. Yeah, they would have to click on that, and it would open the browser on the phone. And then by opening the browser, they would have attempted to trigger the exploit. Dana asked if Claudio had a date for the exploit, and he read the timestamp of the message right off the phone. April 15th, 2018. This, I think, appears also in the browser history, Claudio explained, pointing to the malicious domain name. This basically means that she probably clicked on the link at the time. Wait, sorry. What shows you that she probably clicked on it? Could be because it appeared also in the cell phone's project history, Claudio explained. Okay. And there's another one, Claudio said, while scrolling through the phone's SMS messages. This is a bit older. So just to point this out, Dana said, still processing the first date she'd heard, April 15th, 2018. This is before the murder. The revelation that evening was like so many in the middle stages of the Pegasus Project, a major leap ahead and still a bit short of the mark. We could say without caveat that an end user of Pegasus had attempted to infect a mobile phone belonging to someone in Khashoggi's most intimate circle, his wife. But Android phones simply don't retain enough digital information. There was no data usage log to record any of the malicious process executions, for instance, to quickly or easily provide evidence of a successful infection, or to allow us to say with certainty which Pegasus end user had made the attacks. Claudio trudged off that night with Hanan's two cell phones tucked in his backpack, promising to take a closer look back at his hotel that night. I'm going to do some more digging, he said. The one-on-one digital forensic session with Dana marked the end of two long and difficult days for Claudio, and for Laurent and me, and everybody else on the Pegasus Project. We were in the middle of a 3.5-day conference Laurent and I had convened to reveal our investigation to a wider set of journalists and to settle on a plan going forward. We had made enormous progress in that short stretch, but still had a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of nervous new partners deciding how to handle the big, hot cyber surveillance potato we had just dropped in their laps. The first circle of partners, Le Monde, Die Zeit, Süddeutsche Zeitung, and the Washington Post, had all sent reporters and editors, some of them new to the team. The newer partners, all of whom had joined the project when they agreed to allow the security lab to run the forensics on employee phones, also sent reporters. This included The Wire from India, Direct 36 from Hungary, Aristegui Noticias and Proceso from Mexico, and the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP, which specialized in Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. The least settled journalists in Paris were from the media organizations who were learning the details of the Pegasus Project for the first time. Folks who knew nothing of the specifics of the leak and nothing of our reporting to date. The Belgian daily Le Soir and the Belgian weekly investigative magazine Canuck. The Beirut-based media site Darage, and The Guardian, headquartered in London. The Guardian, with an editorial staff of more than 600 and a daily average readership approaching a million, offered the Pegasus Project an opportunity for remarkable reach and a solid team of reporters and editors. We had been eager to inform The Guardian about the data leak and get them on board, because we knew exactly what their team would bring to the Pegasus Project. The newspaper had enormous resources, and Stephanie Kirchgassner and a few of The Guardian's other journalists had been doing very good reporting on cyber intelligence for many years. The Guardian had also been a trusted partner of Forbidden Stories going back to our very first project. not including the London-based media outlet in the first circle of the Pegasus Project, had been a really tough call. But Laurent and I were so afraid for the security of our source that we made the difficult choice to keep the circle smaller than we had wanted. And as soon as we reached out to Paul Lewis, The Guardian's investigative editor, in late April, he began gathering a small team to join us for the meeting in Paris. Part of the allure, Paul later admitted, was the chance to get out of London, where he had been stuck during the year-long COVID pandemic. Not that our city was great fun at that point. President Emmanuel Macron had just extended France's third COVID lockdown, which meant all bars, restaurants, museums, and theaters remained closed. Streets were eerily quiet during the day, and ghostly after 7 p.m., the hour of the officially enforced curfew. All of the partners and potential partners who first gathered on the afternoon of May 11, 2021, had submitted negative results from their recently completed PCR tests. An editor from The Wire who was scheduled to attend was unable to leave India because he tested positive. The initial sessions of the 3.5-day conference, Tuesday afternoon and Wednesday morning, were loose free-for-alls at our office in the Bastille district. We had set up workstations where each of the new partners could get on a secure laptop and take a look at the reporting, fact-checking, and forensics done to this point. This was their first look at the secure platform we had set up to communicate with all the partners, where they could post their most recent reporting for all to see, and where the security lab could share the results of its forensic analyses. Claudio and the Forbidden Stories team were there to walk the newly initiated through the steps for entering the platform, then show them how to navigate through various folders, how to update files, and how to do it all in secrecy. Passwords. Lots of them, Paul Lewis remembers of his first session. Various secure protocols. A lot of them. But then, finally, we were in. And I remember looking at that stream of phone numbers with different country codes all over the world. Tens of thousands of phone numbers. Data of this kind had not been leaked before, certainly pertaining to NSO technology used by governments around the world. Not on this scale. Paul was all focus and intensity in those first sessions. Later, I'd realize that's just Paul, one of his colleagues would say. The Guardian's lead investigative editor seemed goggle-eyed as he noted people in the data that we had already identified. The sitting presidents of France and Mexico, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, the former Prime Minister of Belgium, Emirati princesses, the inner circle of the Dalai Lama. The list of identified selections included opposition politicians in the supposedly democratic nations of India, Mexico, and Hungary, human rights activists and lawyers from around the world, journalists by the hundreds, some of them now in prison or assassinated. This could be a game changer, Paul saw immediately, a chance to reveal the growing dangers of NSO and the rest of the for-profit cyber surveillance industry run amok. What really felt overwhelming, Guardian reporter Stephanie Kirchgassner later said, was how could we possibly do justice to this treasure trove of information? As excited as I was from the first moment, there's also a real sense of responsibility. Paul found himself running the mechanics of this investigation over and over in his head. Verification, fact-checking, confirming targeting or infection through forensics, selecting the most exemplary stories, and then scrambling reporters to dig into them. Collaboration was the best way forward, he understood. The only way forward. No single news organization, not Forbidden Stories on its own, not The Washington Post or The Guardian or Le Monde or Süddeutsche Zeitung or Die Zeit, none of us could have done this on our own, he would say. The only way it was going to work is if we all worked together. The scale of the data Paul had seen that first afternoon did little to shake his conviction that this investigation would require months. The best time for publication, by his reckoning, was October 2021. Timing wasn't the only hurdle for Paul. He and a number of other new partners were anxious to hear more about the digital forensics we had been conducting. Claudio Guarnieri had his work cut out for him in session 3 of the meeting, when he was scheduled to present to the partners, old and new, and all professionally skeptical, the security lab's methodology and its findings to date. Claudio's boss, Dana Ingleton, led off the discussion of forensics in the auditorium at Le Monde. This was the first moment representatives of all the Pegasus Project partners had gathered in one room, at the same time, to listen to presentations and ask questions as a group. As any gathering of journalists, the lectures and prepared speeches quickly gave way to questions. Paul Lewis had a big one, which he asked before Dana could hand off the program to Claudio. "You said you don't know who will peer review, but can you just explain a bit more about what that means? Is it the report that's peer reviewed, or is it the actual forensics that you're offering to another party to do their own analysis on? How do you envisage that?" Dana said she'd let Claudio answer the technical aspects of the question, but she wanted to explain one thing. The layman's term is that the peer review of the report will be a peer review of the forensics, right? She said. The problem, and I don't think it's a bad problem, it's a great problem. It's that a lot of this is really new techniques. If everybody knew how to do these forensics, we wouldn't be in the position we're in. This has been a lot of figuring it out as we go, so there isn't necessarily one person that could look at it and be like, "That's exactly right according to the textbook." Claudio and Danica, she wanted it understood, were writing a whole new textbook, much of it from scratch. I wondered if maybe Claudio was chafing a bit already. He understood the necessity for peer review, but it was like his abilities were being called into question before he had had a chance to say a word. He also understood that Citizen Lab, while unspoken, was at the center of this peer review discussion. Citizen Lab was probably the best known and best regarded cyber surveillance weapons tracker in the world at that point, particularly concerning NSO and its Pegasus system. But Laurent and I, as well as the entire team at Amnesty International Security Lab, were a bit reluctant to involve researchers from Citizen Lab in the project this early, when secrecy was crucial. We managed to table the discussion of peer review for later and move on to Claudio's formal talk. The agenda we had distributed allotted a little more than an hour for Claudio to walk all the partners through the data we had been given access to, the forensic methodology that he and Danica had put in place, and the results they had achieved so far. 2 hours later, Claudio still had the stage. His formal presentation was interrupted by questions from the audience, but the longer he talked, the less those questions felt like challenges, and the more they felt like genuine curiosity. The more Claudio talked, the more inquisitive these journalists became. Claudio's presentation, stop and go as it became, was detailed and masterful. He explained exactly how the Security Lab's forensic tool had been evolving in the last couple of years, and exactly how the tool was learning to find previously unseen evidence of Pegasus attacks and infections. He was also frank about the limitations. He and Danica, for example, were unlikely to ever find a copy of the spyware on an infected phone. "The malware is not actually stored on the phone," Claudio said in answer to one question. "So if you reboot the phone, or your battery runs out, the infection cleans up. But the Pegasus end users don't care, because they were just going to re-attack you again at the next opportunity. And that's just pretty automatic. They could decide on Tuesday, we'll just get all the SMS messages, and then we'll get them again on Thursday. It's as opportunistic as it gets, because there is no condition that stops them from being successful. As long as they have the exploit working, they can exploit you like 5 times a day, and just upload whatever they want in that particular moment." He also offered the journalists in the room a brief history lesson, walking them through the various stages of the evolving and improving Pegasus technology. From the crude, social engineering and SMS-based one-click exploits, to the multiple reconstitutions of the Pegasus internet infrastructure, to the deviously tweaked process execution names that mimicked legitimate iOS process names, and finally, to NSO's mastery of zero-click, zero-day exploits that took advantage of vulnerabilities its researchers had discovered in iMessage and Apple Photos. Even if Apple found a breach and patched it, Claudio explained, NSO was often capable of finding a new vulnerability and engineering a new exploit. Craig Timberg, who covered tech and tech companies for The Post, stopped Claudio for clarification. He seemed a bit surprised that the world's most security-conscious tech company hadn't blocked Pegasus. If iMessage is the main attack vector at this point, is there something about the way Apple has engineered iMessage that makes it particularly vulnerable? He asked. Is there something that they should be doing to make it harder, to make it less likely? Claudio paused for just a bit, as I had seen him do hundreds of times before, and mulled. He meant to be precise in what he said. So it's not necessarily something that Apple has done wrong with iMessage, he explained. The reason why it is so popular is the same reason why SMS messages with links were very popular at one time. And then NSO abandoned that because they got caught too often. But the reason essentially is that they know that that iMessage application will be on every iPhone. So it's a very juicy target from an exploitation perspective, because once you have one exploit, you can exploit all of them. Near the end of his presentation, Claudio told the group that time might be running out on the security lab's investigation, because Pegasus attacks were becoming more sophisticated and more difficult to detect. He suspected that NSO engineers might even be aware that the security lab, or somebody else, was now stalking Pegasus. The Watchers were watching the Watchers watching the Watchers. They definitely have taken notice of people doing forensics, I suppose, Claudio explained. If the phone is compromised, they can see that someone is doing a backup, for example, or they might be able to. So it's becoming more difficult to do the forensics exactly for that reason. And when I say it's becoming, I mean as of the last 4 weeks. They are evidently taking steps, so it's becoming harder is the first issue. The second issue is the more we do it, the more they will pay notice. And to me, that's why it's critical that we move as fast as we can. There's nothing we can do to be invisible in this process from a technical point of view. Nearly 2 hours in, Paul Lewis raised his hand. Can I ask three just really quick questions? He said. But first of all, I want to say thank you because it's a really impressive body of work. The entire audience burst into applause. The group was plainly dazzled by what they had heard. The question of peer review kept coming up in other sessions, and one of those exchanges elicited from Claudio maybe the most telling statement of the entire conference. To be frank, it was kind of surprising. Not what Claudio said, but that he said it aloud. I had been working closely with Claudio for 8 or 9 months by then, and he had always been careful not to overstate the results of the forensic analyses that he and Danica had been conducting. He was almost allergic to overhype, especially in front of a group of journalists. So he delivered this mini soliloquy in his inimitable manner. He didn't raise the volume of his voice or change the tone or even move forward in his auditorium seat. I wanted to spend a couple of words, I guess, to contextualize what I believe is the value of the forensic evidence we have got so far, he told the full contingent of partners. The leads that the data is giving us are extraordinary because the amount of success we're having with the forensics is, to me, unprecedented. And let me tell you that I've been working on the surveillance industry for a decade. I have probably checked hundreds of computers and phones in these years. And if I had a 0.5% success before this, it would have been good. And now I think we're close to 80%. So to me, that's a sign that this is pretty strong. This was the boldest assertion I had ever heard Claudio make about his confidence in the data and in the forensics. At that point, he even allowed himself a quick chuckle, as if he might have surprised himself. "We have all of the documentation that is needed," he continued. "The technical findings are ready to be aggregated and going to be made available as soon as necessary. And we'll make that available to whoever the group decides needs to vet the work." The other sessions included presentations by the first circle of partners about the work they had already done and the stories they were already pursuing. We covered Mexico, Hungary, Morocco, India, Azerbaijan, among others. The presentation on Saudi Arabia was the longest because the Khashoggi case was central to this project. "This would be a big deal, you know, because NSO has managed to kind of wiggle out of their responsibility in this," said one presenter. There were discussions about how to divide up the reporting in different countries, who might have ins at NSO, and what kind of response we could expect from the company in the lead-up to publication. We took time to discuss some basic ground rules: never mention NSO to a source, verify every phone number in the data, with double or triple sourcing before publishing a name, and ask permission from the victims and the selected targets before publishing their names, at least for people who were not public figures. We also took some time to discuss the proper order of the stories, which would likely roll out over 4 or 5 days, the need to have some understandings about what we would not be able to assert, and the question of how much editorial leeway the partners would have in shaping their own packages. Everybody agreed that the great opportunity of this investigation was that we could reveal the shocking scale of the weaponization of cyber surveillance tools. But the scale also had its drawbacks, as was evident from the discussions we had about timing. The group had basically agreed to our suggestions about leading with the stories of human rights activists and journalists, and holding the big names for later days. We also agreed on optimal timing for when to approach government officials, politicians, celebrities, spokespeople at Apple, and other tech companies, and especially officials from NSO and their client countries. The only truly difficult issue was the publication date. Laurent and I were pushing for the middle of July, which was only about 8 weeks away. The Guardian had come to Paris hoping to persuade us to push our deadline back to the fall. After almost 3 days of meetings, it was apparent that the Guardian was not alone. Craig Timberg of the Washington Post had trouble seeing how we were going to pack all this work into 2 months. He counted at least 8 stories he thought the Post would want to tackle, and time to do maybe 3 of them well. He said, "We are going to enter a world of trade-offs of time versus depth and quality." I thought we were already close to having solid publishable stories in Mexico, India, Morocco, and Hungary. With a little luck, we could nail down the Khashoggi story. The more we prolonged this investigation, the greater the chance of burning our source. "Just based on the stories in the work, mid-October is much more reasonable," I heard Laurent tell one of our new partners. "But this is based on the risk assessment for the source." Bastian Obermeier of Süddeutsche Zeitung stepped up and defended our choice of July. He reminded everybody that we probably had enough leads in the data to report for 6 years and not exhaust the stories, and the initial publication was hardly the end of the investigation. "Once we throw a stone in the water, there will be the chance that the story develops, that more sources will come up to us and say, 'Listen, I've got more,'" Bastian said. "We're not throwing a small stone in the water. We have this big chunk." In the end, it was Paul Lewis who really summarized the meetings and the near future for the entire collaboration with his own proposed trade-offs. He wanted a measure of editorial flexibility for each of the partners, and something even more crucial. The whole project obviously rests on the data, the interpretation of the data, and the forensics, he told the group. The work that Claudio and AI have done has been phenomenal. It's really fantastic. I'm in awe. But it is just one organization, and we need to be 100% sure. So for me, the peer review is really key here. And I think it's in all of our interests. I think it's in your interest, AI's interest, for us to be completely 100% sure on this. And I think if we can fix those two things, if we can be collectively comfortable with the peer review, and if we can all have more flexibility as news organizations, I think late July is possible for us.